we're not quite as focused on the public trust here. We're going to return to it on our next couple of stops. What we wanted to do here was to dig into the ethics a little bit more. So you remember last time, what I was trying to do is I was trying to make the case for an intrinsic value ethic where you value the land for what it is, for how it's evolved, for that long sweep of history, for the products of this evolutionary process. You know, you look out there and you sort of think, wow, this forest kind of belongs because that's how nature wanted it to be. I mean, that's kind of what the argument is, that nature made it into something like that. So, that's fine, except when it's not fine. And it's not fine when humans are already shaping stuff. Or when human impact is such that you can no longer talk of a landscape being pristine or pure or natural or something like that. And arguably, that's where we are now. Arguably, now we're in the Anthropocene. You can't put too much stock in this idea of pristine, untouched nature because, you know, with climate change, with invasive species, with logging, with beetle kill, maybe the whole shebang is now impacted and altered. So if that's the case, I need to revise what I was saying at the last stop, and I need to kind of move away from people like Leopold, and I need to have an argument that, well, a moderate amount of human interference or human management of these natural processes is okay. And, you know, maybe the public trust doctrine has to accept a moderate amount of intervention and manipulation. Maybe humans are now integrated into these landscapes in ways that we can't avoid. So if that's the case, I wanted to give three or four examples of ways that humans might integrate themselves into these processes, and that might be a good thing. So just to recap, what we're doing is we're shifting away from the idea that there's untouched nature that we need to hold in public trust and we need to preserve. And we're moving into a sort of Anthropocene where there's no untouched nature. Humans have to manipulate and manage the landscape, and perhaps there's a new version of public trust which would incorporate that. So what I want to do is give four examples of human manipulation, different conservation practices where humans actually get involved and manage the landscape, and I want your feedback on whether these are okay. So the first one is called facilitated adaptation. So what is this? Well, because of climate change, some species are facing challenges they haven't faced before. So white-barked pine, for example, are facing a blister rust. And it's just wiping out the white-barked pine. And we stand to lose a lot of these high elevation white-barked pine forests. Now, there are some white-barked pines that have the genetics to resist the assault of these pathogens. Problem is, there aren't many of them, and problem is, the forest as a whole is perhaps not adapting quick enough to the pathogens. So what if we facilitate adaptation? So what would be involved? Well, you'd grab some white-barked pines that were surviving blister rust, you'd take them back to the nursery, and you'd propagate them like crazy. When you'd propagated enough of them, and you tested them to make sure they were resistant, you'd rush them back up onto the hillside and you'd plant them in the dying forest and you would save that forest. So this is a type of adaptation, but it's facilitated by humans. So you can do that with white-barked pines. You could potentially do it with corals. So because of warming oceans, you know, we've got this horrible coral bleaching problem. But there are some corals and the symbionts that live in the corals. There are some that resist those higher temperatures. So what if you find them? You take them out of their in-situ environment, you breed them like crazy. One thing you can do with corals, which I just learned about, is they call it micro-fragmenting. So you get a horn coral, so a horn coral has sort of lots of fingers on it, and you snap them off. You keep snapping off the fingers, and then you glue the fingers on the ground, and the coral sort of re-sprouts. So what if you found the ones that were resistant to the heat, and you fragmented them like that and grew all these corals until you had enough coral that was heat resistant that you could start to rebuild a reef. So white bark pines, corals, facilitated adaptation. Does that sound like a good idea or a bad idea?
They're officially GMO, right?
Well, I haven't yet altered the genome. What I've done is...
you haven't combined them.
Yeah. What I've just done is I found the ones that are resistant, and I've tried to speed along the breeding.
Well, the problem, I don't know about the forest one, but certainly with the corals, you've got an entire ecosystem, and so you can maybe get corals that are adapted to the warmer water, but what about other fish and so on that keep the reef alive? If they can't survive in the warmer water and they leave, the corals will die of other reasons.
Mm-hmm. So you just can't do enough facilitated adaptation. Like, you might be able to save the coral, but you'd have lost the fish by then, so...
Well, I'm not saying it wouldn't work. I'm saying it's not a solution in and of itself, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like.
Because you have to think of it in the context of the rest of its environment.
Yeah.
The larger ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. I'd say you do it because that's basically why we have a civilization. I mean, we domesticated wheat, so we kind of already started this process, mm-hmm. You know, 15,000 years ago, we're kind of stuck in it. But
tomatoes don't grow.
Got to be careful with it. I mean, the unintended consequences things, I think, is a...
Yeah.
That, you know, we do that a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think coral is a keystone species, so, I mean, those fish won't be there if the coral's not there, so...
Right.
But you don't
know, I mean,
the coral
yeah.
is like a first step, I guess.
Yeah.
If anything else, the fish will adapt if the coral is there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More likely they'd adapt to fresh coral than if they don't have the coral.
Yeah.
So it is a way of extending domestication. You know, that's sort of the thing that I think is interesting about it, is you sort of make that coral reef into a kind of domesticated reef because you brought it out of the ocean, you propagated it, or you brought the white pine off the mountain, you grew it in the nursery, and then you took it back out there. So it's a type of domestication. So the wild landscape becomes a little more domesticated. Let's go to another example, genetic rescue. So now we are talking about genetic modification. So what sort of genetic modification might we want to do? Well, there was a good case that seemed to work where the Florida panther was reduced to something like 20 to 30 individuals. And they were so inbred that they were getting these problems like these kinked tails, and the species was kind of on the way out. So what they did is they brought in some Texas panthers and they had them breed with the Florida panthers just to increase the genetic diversity. So what effectively that means is humans manipulate the genomes to give that species a better chance. So you can do it just by letting two panthers breed, or you could do it by genetic modification. You could go into the lab and you could introduce a gene. And this is actually what they're doing with some corals, is they're introducing a gene deliberately to make the coral able to withstand bleaching. Both of those cases you could call genetic rescue, because you're using a sort of your wisdom and knowledge about genetics to change the genome of a species so that it survives better under these conditions. So I would say that's a little more aggressive than just taking a species out and breeding it and putting it back. It's a little more aggressive because you're actually consciously changing a genome, deliberately, in the lab maybe. What do you think of that?
I think it's fine, you know, if Texas panthers bred with Florida ones, that happened by accident anyway, you know, for thousands and millions of years. That's it. That's just I'm evolution. But when you start going to the lab and injecting genes from one, you know, messing with individual cells artificially, that's another whole frontier there, which I don't think happens naturally.
Yeah.
So it's a. I draw the line at the panthers.
We're doing it by accident all the time, mm-hmm. just in our activities, our daily activities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, intentional versus by accident, I don't know if there's a...
So what the...
Aren't they doing the genetic manipulation with the chestnut tree?
That was one of my later examples.
Okay.
Do they do it with apple trees? They did it with bananas when bananas were failing.
So is there something, I'm interested in this question, like, so let's say you want to rescue the panther, and, you know, as you said, if the species can breed, then that's pretty natural, right? But you go to Texas, you capture one, you collar it, you put it in a truck, you drive it over to Florida, you put it in a breeding facility, you make the opportunity so that these two animals can breed and the genes of the Texas panther can go into the Florida one. Isn't that a pretty substantial intervention, or is it not? It's substantial enough to really matter.
Well, again, I think it's just, we're the agent in this case. In former times, eons, there might be some other agent which would have the same effect. You know, there's no basic hard chemistry involved. It's mm-hmm. just a natural process.
Well,
and I'm not sure exactly where I'm venturing here, but it seems that it's something that conceivably could happen naturally without our intervention.
Mm. Well, it could have been our intervention that caused it. If, you know, human hunting and stuff is what split the species into the Florida and Texas one, you're just undoing what was done 200 years before.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To be devil's advocate, though, what's the appeal? You used the term naturally several times. What makes that better, you know, that it could occur naturally versus in a lab?
I guess, I'm awfully shaky ground here, but I tend to think that if you have to go into a lab and have all kinds of, you know, if you take apart a cell, take apart a gene, and start splicing genes artificially, okay, maybe that isn't entirely natural. I don't know. You got me there.
My intuition tells me that you're right, but I just it's hard to justify.
My intuition does too, but I can't quite figure what my intuition is up to here.
Yeah.
That's a problem I have a lot.
I think one of the problems with it, my point of view, is that like the difference is that anything that naturally occurred had the correct time to form into that organism, so it's going to fit. If we take a thing like a tomato and a fish, we don't know what that's going to do later. We're just like monkeys just screwing around with stuff we do not understand. That's why I think I think you got to do it sometimes, but you don't know what you might do later. Mm-hmm. And so it's like just a classic, you know, messing with a technology that you do not understand. There's been millions of movies about
that.
So it's like we could be doing something great or doing something that later on down the road we just was like, oh geez, like what do we do now?
Well,
I don't think that you can necessarily say we don't always understand the implications. I mean, there certainly may be long-term implications. That's why I brought up the chestnut tree, because that's it's a much simpler case than panthers. I mean, messing with the genome of a panther is pretty complex, but simply turning on a gene that makes something resistant to a bacteria is a lot simpler, and I think they probably do understand that. And so I think there's a really wide range of what you can do and what is understandable in the short term and long term and what's not.
Let me put two more examples on the table, because I think these two examples kind of might straddle some of the questions that we're asking here. So one example of a practice is assisted migration. It's a little bit like facilitated adaptation, in the sense that humans see a problem, they intervene, and they try and sort of create a situation that would be advantageous. So the problem here would be a species that is getting threatened by climate change, its environment is becoming too dry or too hot, but you know there's an environment somewhere else that could support that species. And so you help it migrate by capturing it in the environment in which it's struggling, putting it on the back of a truck, driving it 100 miles north or 200 miles north, and then putting it back into the system in that new location. So you help it migrate. And this has been done, there's a couple of cases in the UK, interestingly, with some butterflies. Which were starting to struggle where they were because temperature lines in the UK are moving north at about 2 miles a year, which is extraordinary. So these butterflies are finding it harder and harder to live where they are. And you think, well, why can't a butterfly just fly north? The answer is there's things like cities in the way that don't have the food supplies. So the butterfly can't fly north to a cooler climate. It has to literally be put on the back of a truck and driven north. So that is a form of intervention. It's a form of, well, it's maybe not domestication, but it's a way of humans deciding what the landscape looks like. So, you know, if you look out here, imagine saying, all right, well, I want that organism that was living over there to live up there now. And that organism that used to be down there in that valley, we're going to put that right on that peak over there. So the whole landscape gets sort of redesigned by humans. For the sake of the species, you know, we want the species to survive, but we're changing the landscape so that it works in the way we think it's going to have to need to work in a couple more generations. So that's assisted migration. And the last one I want to put on the table is the idea of a gene drive. Now, with a gene drive, we're back into biotechnology. And what we're doing with a gene drive is we're going into the lab and we're deciding that a species needs a particular gene to survive some sort of challenge. And we're putting that gene into the germline of the species in the lab. And then we take that species out of the lab and we let it loose again. And every time it breeds, it spreads that gene. So every child it has that new gene. So that's a gene drive. And what's happening is the genetic trait that the humans have decided is the right one is getting driven out through a landscape. So we're on the cusp of making this technology actionable. So I could say, for example, you know, the insect that's causing that tree a problem out there, I'm going to drive a termination gene through that insect population. And I'm going to cause that insect population to crash. Or I'm going to cause that insect population to not be able to transmit a certain disease or something like that. That's what a gene drive does. It's the latest form of biotechnology. And again, I think it's in the same sort of category as these other things I've been describing. Because humans are going to say, all right, we see a problem. We're going to manipulate the landscape in a way that we think is going to be advantageous. And we're going to transform what we see out there. So what do you think of those two, assisted migration and gene drive?
I keep coming back to the whole web of life idea. Everything's hooked up to everything else. I think about your butterfly in England. You move them north, and there's stuff already living north. I mean, do you bring his southern niche up there with him? And what happens to the northern niche of the guys who are already thriving up there and now they have new competition, and they might be driven to the edge by this invader. I mean, it gets
complicated fast, yeah. Isn't it?
I'm not sure how any of these decisions are different from what decisions were made 50 or 60 years ago, like to stop forest fires. And all of that happened where they said, oh, forest fires are damaging, so they stopped them, and now look at what's happening. And there's always the argument forest fires have naturally adjusted the landscape for all those years, and by keeping them from happening, we actually did damage to the landscape. But how is what we're deciding to do to alter the landscape now for the future, how is that different from what we thought were the right decisions for 60 years ago?
Yeah. It might.
Because we have better science for it, or I don't know.
Well, the genetic modification ones are different because it's genetic modification. You know,
right.
It gets into the genome in a way that stopping a forest fire doesn't. But you're right.
Making that damage happen.
Another
again.
Mistake,
I'm not sure how that
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And it brings into focus the question, like, is it better to kind of back off and let nature do its thing? Or is it better to, like, keep managing it in different ways until eventually we get it right, or until eventually we get it so wrong that it kills the bubble?
Yeah, well, how do we know? And I think adjusting our behavior is the first thing, as opposed to...
But one thing that's different is that we do know that, you know, 40 years from now, it's going to be 2 to 3 degrees hotter. So, I mean, that is not something that happened that you know, when they were talking about, you know, not letting forest fires happen, they didn't know that that would have, you know, longer term effects. We already know certain longer term effects are coming, and we have to deal with them.
But just as a devil's advocate, there are people who say this is the transition of our planet, and it's been going on for a million years, that you see those cycles of the freeze-thaw. So,
but we know that that humans have caused the temperature cycle to change at a rate that it's never changed before.
And if we make these adjustments, is that going to turn things backward? Are we going to actually solve the problem by making these genetic modifications?
Well, it doesn't solve the problem of climate change, but it says, okay, I think the goal is this butterfly will go extinct unless we do something. So we have the choice of letting it go extinct for reasons which we caused, or we can try to ameliorate our bad decisions about climate by moving this butterfly.
So I'm going to hand over to Patrick now, but what I hope these sorts of questions prompt us to think about is, if we are going to have something like a public trust doctrine, and if we are going to have included in that doctrine the protection of the intrinsic values of a landscape, then how much manipulating and changing of that landscape can the public trust doctrine accommodate without it all just collapsing into a mess of, well, we did this here, so we have to do this here, and how much do we sort of get past Leopold into a whole different future? But anyway, Patrick had a few things to add, so.
Yeah. So I think the word that kind of popped in my head that Christopher's getting at, and I think some of you guys are, is this notion of wildness and how valuable leaving something alone versus intervening is, especially in a world that we have today and the amount of impacts we've had. So what I was going to do is basically give you guys two kind of proposed solutions to this wildness problem, and maybe have you guys think about what the term wild means to you and what is good or what is bad about humans intervening or non-intervening. So one of the, I worked a little bit, or actually quite a bit, in wilderness ethics and management when I was doing my doctorate, and one of the biggest problems there was in a wilderness area, as maybe you guys, some of you guys know, is to remain untrammeled, and what that means essentially is a byword for to remain wild. So humans do nothing. We backpack, we leave no trace, we get out. No matter what's happening, we allow the landscape to do what it does, essentially remain wild. But wilderness is kind of is not immune to these impacts we've been talking about, just because there's a border, artificial border around it. So you've got climate change, you've got white bark pine, as Christopher was talking about earlier, is particularly problematic in wilderness areas. So there's a lot of desire to intervene, and in the case of white bark pine, breed resistant species and then replant them in a wilderness area. But a lot of people find that violates the wildness of a wilderness area, or for that matter, any area. So one of the solutions that people have proposed in this case is basically a time-limited intervention. So we were kind of getting at this notion of, we kind of get on this hamster wheel where, you know, you do one thing, then you do another thing, and then pretty soon you're just keeping up with all of the changes you've caused. So some people propose this idea that we set a goal, we set a timeline, we go in, we do what we said we're going to do, and then we pull out and withdraw. And that, in essence, temporarily limits or degrades the wildness of the landscape. But once you withdraw, you've restored this wildness back, essentially. So an example would be removing non-native fish from a mountain lake or a stream. In fact, Forest Service is doing that in Montana, or proposing to do it. And the Bob Marshall Wilderness is one place.
And then restoring or reinstalling native species so the populations can thrive and be restored. That's a pretty easy clear-cut example with an end goal. And so I guess some of the problems with that people have are how do we determine when our goal is reached? What are we looking for? How do we determine what's the right state for this ecosystem or this landscape? Do we use something like historical conditions, or like Christopher mentioned earlier, you know, do we look back to this pristine past and use that as our model to restore? And does that even make sense in a rapidly warming and altered world where those conditions might not ever exist again, and us trying to recreate them is kind of a fool's errand? So those are just some of the problems with that approach. Like, maybe you guys can think about that a little more and see what you think. And the next one is a little wacky, but believe it or not, this is true. People are actually proposing this. I thought it'd be fun to at least mention. A couple of scientists and conservationists, I believe, Christopher, I forgot who was in that group, wrote a paper proposing to use artificial intelligence to restore wildness. And keep in mind, this is very hypothetical at this point. But they're talking about these kind of imaginary machines. Well, that's far imaginary. That would be installed on landscapes, and basically what they would be in the minds of these folks is a non-human presence on a landscape that operates to remove human impact, so maybe filters out pollution, restores habitat, so on and so forth. I know it's hard to picture because this is very science fiction, but people are really thinking about this stuff and proposing it. And the idea is it would be like a learning machine. It would be deep learning software, I think is what they call it. And Ross, you could probably weigh in on this more than I could. But and the idea is it would learn the landscape. It would learn what works and what doesn't. And what I personally think is a sleight of hand, these folks are saying, technically that landscape remains wild because we're not there. Our machines are there doing this. And not only that, but we're not really in control of them. They're learning as they go and developing their own approach to these landscapes. Probably some pretty obvious problems with that. I'd like to hear what you guys think, but you know, those are human constructed, human created for a human purpose. So does it really make sense to call those landscapes wild just if these machines are operating here? And is that really our vision of what wildness is? If we've reached that point where we're using robots, I don't know if the word needs to be redefined or our values, you know, might have to shift. So, I don't know, I'm just putting those two out there to see what you guys think about those in terms of solutions to whether or not wildness is even important to consider anymore. Are we going to start thinking of ourselves as gardeners of a planet or farmers in this planet versus allowing nature to do its thing? So,
is anyone else imagining the Sleeper movie, the Woody?
Oh. Which I'm not familiar with.
Sleeper? Woody Allen did a movie back in the mid-70s, I guess, where he falls asleep and wakes up like 150 years later or something in a mushroom-shaped house. You should watch it.
I just remember the Orgasmatron.
That's exactly what popped into my head.
I'm
the nerd.
I first thought on the AI was that, like, so the AI is going to be out there and it's going to figure out, you know, the best way to get this landscape natural is get rid of the people. Like, that'll fix the problem right there.
Yeah.
Let's just get right to it.
So one question I think that I have, one of your original questions was the idea of wildness in itself before even getting to the two other things you mentioned. And in my mind, I have a hard time thinking, I don't necessarily think it's impossible to think of wildness involving the humans. I think oftentimes our language, I think we tend to forget that we are part of the natural world too. We are of nature. And so I think to a certain extent that there's an artificial distinction between what's wild and wildness and placing human beings on the outside of it. But I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I know in the past I've looked actually at definitions of wild and wildness in history and in dictionary books, dictionary books. They're dictionaries.
They are books.
Yeah, that's what it is.
They're not all
dictionaries, and some of the definitions, the majority have actually explicitly had humans, held humans outside of that realm of nature, and I always found that very interesting and disturbing a bit, because I think that we are very much part of it, and part of the problem of language at times can create, I guess it can create more of a problem by removing us from the natural world element, this idea of, I mean, I think of like the wild child. Like the wild child we always associate that tends to be a little more off the cuff, or I don't know, but
yeah,
I don't know. My head goes to, you can be absolutely in nature and have that wildness thing. It doesn't necessarily need to be untrammeled.
Sure.
We were just having that conversation on our way up the mountain about application of being able to have these discussions with people who don't think deeply about these things, who don't have the language or the family structure to understand what we're talking about, or the education, and how you can get people to think along these terms. And you just, the light bulb just went on when you said we are part of it. Maybe part of that language is reintroducing ourselves as part of the wild world, that we have a wildness about us, and approaching it in that context.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, I think you can make the case that, sadly, there's no such thing as part of the Earth that's untouched anymore. I mean, they found plastic in the Marianas Trench, there's DDT in the North Pole, you know, the temperature has changed everywhere. Maybe that's something, you know, that's completely lost, and what we have to do is recover as much of it as possible and just admit that everything now is artificial.
So I want to push back a little bit against what Maurice said there, in as friendly a way as possible. And I'm going to do it just by looking out this way. So if you just kind of look that way. On our left, we have a sort of urban environment, a cultural environment, an industrial environment. You know, people are really shaping it in a serious, big way. And most of the people in our viewshed live there. And then on our right, we have a landscape that is a little bit shaped. Certainly shaped by climate change, shaped by logging that took place 100 years ago. There are, you know, a couple of houses I can see, you know. But I think you can still make the case that the environment to our left is a cultural environment, and the environment to our right is considerably more of a natural environment. And, you know, we like that environment because it holds the wildlife and, you know, it provides the sort of breathing space from the city. So when, you know, Marisa says, well, we should just be thinking of ourselves as being natural and ourselves as being wild, and just sort of accept that we're part of it, I find myself saying, well, no, I want to hesitate a little bit, because I want to look at these two landscapes and say, that's the cultural one and that's the natural one, and I want to keep that divide in place.
I think natural and wild are two really different words, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the the broader issue, I've struggled with that same question, Marisa, because wildness to me, especially in the beginning when I looked into it, and you know, it's, and I had my own notions of it when I approached it, it sounds wonderful in a lot of ways. It's very appealing. I think just trying to find what's the moral language then, or the terminology we can use to really capture that difference that Christopher's trying to point out here, because there is a real difference. I don't know how to articulate it very well. And then more importantly, how do we capture or use moral language to say this is wrong because blank, you know? And so everybody's got their word, natural, wild, so on and so forth. So that's not really an answer, but I feel like, you know, that's at the heart of all this, is trying to figure out how to talk about it in a way that captures real damage and real loss, without making appeals to words that don't really have a foundation. So,
you know, I kind of see it, you know, since we live here and doing all this stuff, the whole world's cultural landscape, actually. And, you know, and the problem lies, I think personally, in figuring out, okay, how the heck do we get a better handle on our culture? you know, it's a cultural thing, and
it is
you
now.
Know, I keep thinking in terms of urban design. And looking to my left, you see the old part of town. In 1890, the population was about one third where it is now, and it lived in the area that's roughly where the older tree cover is, the old green part of town there, about 3 square miles. And now that we drive everywhere, what can be called urbanized is spread over the whole valley, you know, and that's a cultural thing. And so we have this cultural ability to make a decision about how you want to live that has an enormous influence. And is it possible to look at the influence of, you know, I'm kind of cherry pick things we do and say, okay, this has a huge influence. Is there some way I can pull back on that? You know, in my case, is walking instead of driving. You know, and there's dozens of different things we can apply. And is it within our ability to draw back our culture so we have less a negative influence on what's surrounding us? Being human involves thinking and inventing things and manipulating things and changing our environment to a certain extent, but to what extent can we pull back on that ability for the sake of everything else in the world? I think I'm making it sound too simple or too cut and dried, but that's sort of the way I can't see any other way of thinking about it, you know, practically, actually.
Yeah.
Culture is a great word to use.
Well, I mean, semantics are important, like you were saying before, because when you use a term like wild or natural, it kind of by default implies not wild and not natural, and that becomes a binary thing. And I think things aren't binary. They're, you know, you see them in degrees, and so this is like more wild than that, because like I was just in Boulder, Colorado, and they have designated open space, gorgeous mountains down there, but there's a million people using that space because they drive up from Denver, and there's 100,000 people in Boulder, and it's like, you know, if you put a million people in Helena, this would be far less wild than it is currently now.
Even
so,
if nothing in the landscape changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but if we put a million people in Helena and said, this is wild land, you can walk up there, but don't take your bike up there, or don't drive up there, or don't take an e-bike up there. And for every one of those decisions, you're pulling back a little bit, and you're increasing the carrying capacity for human presence. I mean, I think our problem is that we have to have so much stuff with us when we go anywhere to have enormous influence. If we're just up here on foot, you know, it's not much of an impact. If I was on a bike, it'd be more of an impact. If I had one of those e-bikes, it'd be more impact yet. And keep going up and up and up. God draw lines somewhere for the sake of, I don't know. It's a self-control thing, I guess. Pulling back on our need to have all our stuff with us,
yeah.
Or keep making more stuff. I don't know.
Well, I was thinking of, go ahead.
Well, Patrick, the concept of wild and defining it, Howard Zanheiser, who wrote The Wilderness Act, and Stuart Brandberg in Montana, and Lee Metcalf, who helped get it through,
mm-hmm.
those do carry terms, but the value of wilderness, you know, was passed in 64, and in a digital age, unless society has those intrinsic values and enjoys or appreciates it, it can't be sustained.
Yeah.
And I think wilderness, as in terms of federal lands, Forest Service, and BLM, has probably reached a high mark in our lifetime, and given increasing pressures from development and the political will of Congress and the presidency now, it doesn't look good for the wild to me.
No.
For the future, it's very discouraging.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the political will needed to pass wilderness legislation just hasn't been there.
Or to maintain what we've got left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say something, if we do we have time, Marisa. Just maybe to kind of bring together, Marisa, your issues with using the term wildness as separating humans. And then, sorry, I didn't get your name. But
Dennis.
Dennis,
yeah.
Dennis, okay. Well, what Dennis was saying, so if we accept that we're part of the natural world and it's wrong to separate us, but we're also acknowledging that we're damaging it profoundly, then it's a problem of integration, right? I mean, if we want to talk about being a part of something, then let's really integrate into being that way. And I think that gets to your cultural argument. Yeah, it's like, how do we integrate a city? Is it really...
Yeah.
Is it acceptable to have effluent running into every river and every town? Why don't we could institute something that says, you know, it's just wrong to introduce anything back into a river. Why don't we take what we need, you know, use technologies, filtration systems, whatever, reintroduce water back into a stream, the same pH, the same temperature, all of that, work to do things like that to integrate into a landscape, I don't know, something like that. So that's this idea of culture, being a culture of integration versus a culture of separation, I guess. Yeah.
I think the rest is almost downhill. So
not all downhill from here, hopefully.
Go back to the I think that might be.
Yeah, and also just looking at time, that might.
Is everybody comfortable? It's going to be slippery. There's it's really rocky on the way back down this way.
So we'll turn that down the line. The prospect shaft.